at the crop.
Welcome to the 90th edition of the Gooner Podcast, recorded on the first Monday evening in November, with the team on a half-decent run of results, as we take a breath, inevitably, for Robin Van Persie to pick up an injury on international duty for Holland. Thanks to our sponsors, GoonerShirts.com, the website for all of your Clueless Arsenal t-shirts. I'm your host, David Udo, and still with me on the panel from our previous recordings this evening are Mark Hollington, Mike Francis and Simon Rose. And for this one and only Gooner podcast this month, we have the editor, Kevin Witcher.
Hello, listeners.
Okay, as we're in November, we're going to run through a few of the significant events and, in more recent times, memories of this month in Arsenal's history. So, first up, a cheeky question for you. We're recording this just a stone's throw away from the tube station, which used to bear the name of the road on which it is situated, Gillespie Road. However, Herbert Chapman successfully campaigned to have it renamed in honour of the team on the 5th of November of which year did it officially become Arsenal? Anyone apart from Kevin Witcher with an answer?
It's got to be, well, 31, something like that, 30, 30.
29.
Mike?
33.
Oh, so close. The tube name was actually changed in Kevin.
It was 1932, and every time a Tottenham fan ventures onto the Piccadilly line and sees the map of that line, now they're absolutely gutted to see that basically we put one over on them. So well done, Herbert.
Well done, Herbert. Yes.
Well done. Well
done. Well, while we're in the Chapman era, the Battle of Highbury took place in November of 1934. Even though it was an England match, do you still take pride in what happened that day, having read about it in Arsenal's history? Anyone in particular? Simon? Oh, Kevin. Anyone?
Well, Simon, do you want to go first?
I think you always have pride in Arsenal and the fact that, you know, there's a match at Highbury and a lot of Arsenal players are involved. I think we were talking before about big games in November, and I think one of the things I really, really miss Highbury, and to think of, you know, great matches that have happened there, it kind of keeps the stadium alive.
Yeah, I mean, realistically, we're currently in a day when there's only one club that could realistically have seven of its players in the same national team, which, depressingly, is probably Manchester United.
Well, it depends if you're talking about the England national team. If you're talking about the French national team, then there was a time when we had a good chance. However, to return to 1934, it's basically, I sometimes very occasionally think, you know, if I was alive in a different era, what games would I have liked to have attended? And I tell you, that's the one, because basically it was a bloody war, but it was also a game in which an England side made up of seven Arsenal players beat the reigning World Cup holders. Mm. Now, this is obviously long before the era of the European Cup, or as they've now bastardised it, to the Champions League. But what Real Madrid did in the 50s, I kind of think Arsenal might have done in the 30s, but basically proving they were the best team in the world. And I think that game, in a way, indicates that you know, Arsenal could have achieved that, because the England team, all right, granted with four non-Arsenal players, but they beat the world champions, and I mean, basically proved that they're at least the match of them. So if you take that down to club level, you know, Italy weren't represented by seven players from one of their clubs. You know, they had a bit more mix and match. So I'm very proud of what Arsenal achieved, you know, albeit as part of an England team on that day, especially given the nature of the actual match, which was effectively, as they say, a battle. You know, there was so many injuries and things going on. So I think it's a wonderful landmark in the club's history, and one I think probably isn't even celebrated enough by the club itself to this day.
After that speech there, Kev, that's going to change pretty sharpish. I'm running up with
there'll
emotion
be a bust,
there.
There'll be a bust for that.
Bust of the seven players, I reckon.
That is a Churchillian type speech, that's what we need.
It was that kind of game.
Amazing.
And the fact that it was at Highbury kind of caps it all, really. You know. And the interesting thing is it was before the days of floodlights, so it was a midweek afternoon. Wow. So you couldn't even get a sellout. You know, the crowd was only about, I don't know, 40,000 or something, in the days when Highbury could quite comfortably take 65, 70. So it's a bit weird thinking that era that you didn't play games at night.
Bear in mind the game's not going to be sold out. It's midweek. It's the daytime. You're coming up with reasons that this was all a big con to get as many people through the gate as quick as possible. This is purely because I'm absolutely miserable when it comes to international football. So I do apologise. Moving back to
tickets for England versus Sweden. Apparently, a family of four can go for £60.
Is that right?
Yes, because the FA cannot shift those tickets.
Oh, my, sweet Moses! And the other friendly, we're supposed to be playing Spain. I say friendly; it can't be a friendly if we lose 7-0. Oi, oi, oi! Moving on.
Indeed.
Moving on.
It's like a Monty Python sketch, this podcast so far.
I've done a few of those.
Well, moving on to an excuse to plug the current issue of the Gooner. Can you recall in which infamous November 1983 match that the mustachioed Ian Allinson made his Arsenal debut, Mike?
It would have been the Walsall game, I believe.
The Walsall game.
The famous Walsall game, or the second famous Walsall game, because there was a famous Walsall game in the 30s, but I don't think it goes quite that far. but we lost to them in the League Cup at Highbury 2-1, I think. And that was his debut. It must have kind of been that far after that, maybe a month, probably less, Terry Neill was sacked.
I can't even pass that round the rest of the panel. That is the correct answer.
Well, thank God for that, because I would have got the answer right. So cheers, mate. Very impressive.
Poor Ian. Fat bloke with a moustache.
Do we have enough memories of the game to pin the blame on Mr. Allinson's moustache?
Was there a deflection of his moustache?
I was only three at the time. So unfortunately, no.
And can we raise its relevance to the current issue of the Gooner?
We can certainly do that, because Ian Allinson is one of the featured players on the article Tashes to Tashes, which features mustachioed Arsenal players.
Absolutely.
Of the era.
And a particular Arsenal owner. I think it should be raised, because although in the previous podcast Mike did give his impressions of the AGM, I happened to be sitting next to him. And one of the first things he said to me was about our owner's hair. and I've seen the picture of Stan meeting the players, and it looks even more obvious there.
It's a wig.
It doth appear so. And frankly, it's the wrong goddamn colour. So I don't know who's...
just the lighting.
I don't know who's advising Mr. Kroenke, but... I mean, I've got no hair. You know what I'm saying? And I'm not proud of it, but I'm not trying to pretend. And sometimes to be a man, you've got to say, okay, it's gone. You know, those days are behind me. This is the reality. And if you don't, sometimes you can end up looking ridiculous.
And the ladies still go for you, Kev, don't they?
Absolutely right. So I've got to be queuing up round the block. So do it with confidence, Stan. Get rid of it. Show us your real self.
Who's your favourite player with a moustache, Mark?
Kevin Richardson. Wow. Only because I was watching the 80, the game against Liverpool on DVD recently, and I forgot actually what a great game he had, and he was good that season, wasn't he?
You remember cursing him when he went down injured, don't you?
Yeah, totally. But look what happened. It was all tactics. He was biding his time. Then the players get their breath back. The funny thing was, is if anyone's got the DVD of the that game, there's a documentary afterwards where a bunch of Arsenal fans, some of which God knows they found them, but they're all there speaking with brilliant hindsight, going, and of course Richardson was down, letting the players get their breath back. It was amazing tactic. At the time, like me, you were swearing at TV. Get Richardson! Get up! But yeah, Kevin Richardson,
man alive.
He had a good couple of good seasons for us.
Yeah, he did.
Simon, favourite mustachioed Arsenal footballer?
When I write about John Matthews in the issue, but I liked Alan Sunderland. I think the hair and the moustache were a great combo. And at the 2005 Cup final, he was sat near to us, and there were two guys behind us that both had Alan Sunderland wigs and moustaches on. They had the kind of kit from that cup final. It was fantastic. And at one point, we turned around to see them, and actually behind them was Alan Sunderland in a box very, very close to us. It was almost like they were part of the same family.
Does he still have a tash?
I'm pretty sure he did, but it was all kind of grey now.
Yeah.
But he was loving the fact that people we're commemorating him at that final. Of course, the connection with United being the finalist. So, yeah, I think he's got a special place.
Fantastic.
My favourite Arsenal player with a moustache of all people is Viv Anderson. He looked great with a tash, in fairness, as though he just used to mark people saying, "I pity the fool who try and score headers at the corners." Moving on to some November games to which we can remember of them, because obviously it's crowned by everyone as being an awful month for Arsenal Football Club, and it's in this month we're going to lose the title. Thankfully we did that in August. Or July, from a certain point of view. So, looking at some November games, what we can remember of them. 2nd of November 1984, finished Manchester United 4, Arsenal 2. It was the Friday night game at Old Trafford, and the first Arsenal League game to be televised live, there or thereabouts, apart from the... Oh, no, that was the Match of the Day game against Liverpool in the 60s. Kev, do you remember anything about that game?
It was an era when I completely lost interest in football, and I was going to music gigs and attempting to discover the pleasures of the opposite sex and enjoying the student life. So I will pass on that. I very rarely watched football between 1982 and 1986. I took a 4-year hiatus.
Anyone choose Arsenal over Depeche Mode? Anyone? Mike?
Of course. Always. Arsenal first. Always. No, I remember the game. It was a Friday night. And it was as you say, it was the first, I believe, it was the first game, league game, televised live. It was on BBC. And I think we took a 2-1 lead. We went 1-0 down, predictably enough. Just like, oh, how times haven't changed. Then we recovered to take a 2-1 lead before falling apart in the second half. And we then played Sheffield Wednesday a few weeks later, which was also live on TV. So oddly, we had two in quick succession.
Was this when Frank
Stapleton scored against us?
Oh, boo! Was this when it was called the big game presented by Elton Wells?
Yeah, it would have been. Yeah, it would have been, wouldn't it? Yeah, that would have been that era.
Man alive.
Does anyone remember other Friday night games?
I remember we beat Leeds
5-0.
Yeah. On Grievous Magic. Was that Good Friday?
No, that was
Liverpool, time. Wasn't it? That was a Liverpool game.
It was an evening game. It was an evening kick off to Friday because we were going to it after work.
We played three Friday games that year because we played Newcastle at the start of the year on a Friday night. Newcastle towards the end of the season when Henry was the best player in the world. And it was...
Yeah, Liverpool on the Good Friday morning.
But it was just that season. I don't remember any others.
Hmm. No. There's the obvious one. Oh, 1989, clearly.
Oh my God.
Of course. Dear, oh dear. This is an Arsenal podcast with Arsenal supporters.
Okay, was it Into the Cure then? He left the Depeche Mode. He was going through his goth phase. It was only back in 92 he got back in love with Arsenal.
Next game I've got is one that I remember because I've got the end of season video, and it's a video rather than a DVD. It's winning 4-1 away at Forest on November the 6th, 1988, when Brian Marwood missed a penalty. Brian Moore goes absolutely crazy, and then we have goals from Alan Smith, Steve Bold, Tony Adams and Brian Marwood in the end, after going a goal down and finishing a 4-1 victory, also live on a Sunday afternoon on TV. Simon, does that ring any bells with you?
Yeah, and that's like the kind of time when you felt with every game that we were going to score, and we were going to score first, and we were going to win. I seem to remember Bold maybe got like a header, one of those kind of stooping headers that sometimes people go for. It's always great when you get a match when if it's a game on TV and the commentary team are talking about all sorts of reasons why Arsenal aren't any good, and then we win and they haven't got much else to say after that because that wasn't what they'd written down to say. Mm-hmm. It's always lovely to see the media proven wrong in a match. But yeah, seasons like that when you really feel you can win any game. I think, you know, November's a great time to be in good form. You know, people heading towards Christmas, lots of matches. If you can be in good form, really sets the tone for the season.
I seem to remember the goals raining in very quickly. I don't know, maybe it's my memory, but I thought we scored all of them in the first half. I could be wrong.
No, because I was at that game. It was horrible weather. It was, I don't know whether it was raining, but it was an open terrace, but it was certainly damp. We scored 3 goals in the second half down our end.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was 1-1 at half time.
I'm getting old.
There was one of the I think we classed as being a typical Arsenal corner goal, which I don't remember too many of actually, where Bowley flicked it on at the near post, yes. And Adams came and stooped in and with a header at the back post.
I
think we only got about three like that.
It was a typical move until Alan Hansen or some such pundit made a feature about it on the TV, and so every opposition player picked that up and thought, oh, well, we've got to stop that again.
Put a man at the near post, yeah.
I do remember when Steve Bold scored, Brian Moore was incredibly surprised, and the scorer is Stephen Bold. he announces, Simon, you mentioned it's one of those seasons where the results are stuff like everything just adds up. Well, the other one I've got is losing 6-2 at home to Man United in the League Cup on the end of November 1990. Anything that anyone remembers about this particular defeat that season?
Lee Sharp.
Aside from Lee Sharp, yeah.
I mean, okay, it's, well, there's some crazy games where everything kind of goes in. It's a bit like this season, the game at United, you know, as awful as we were, they got, you know, free kicks and, you know, long ranges from Ashley Young. Sometimes you get a game where everything goes in and the result possibly looks a lot worse than actually the actual game felt at the time. But, yeah, I mean, 6-2 is obviously is a huge defeat. And that was the season, wasn't it, when we won the league and
almost won
the FA Cup. So it's like a horrendous defeat to have in what's otherwise such an amazing season. That obviously with the other awful defeat we had that season in the
cup. We only lost three competitive games that season.
It's a correct answer.
And even losing that game at Chelsea, wasn't it? Like we were lacking people in defence and
Mickey Thomas playing defence that day. Something
along those lines.
Oh, is that the Chelsea?
Yeah. We ended up with one recognised central defender or no recognised central defenders. I think Bolton off injured, didn't he?
Bolton
off
injured after 5 minutes or something. Yeah.
Ended up scoring in injury time through Alan Smith, didn't he?
Might have been David Hillier, you know.
Possibly so,
instead of Thomas as a centre back.
Possibly.
David Hillier.
With Linegan, was that right?
Reminds me, make sure I know where my baggage is when I get home. November the next year, after winning the first division, we moved into the European Cup, which England clubs were allowed to do after our ban in Europe was lifted. Many thanks to Liverpool fans for that. We lost 3-1 at home to Benfica at the beginning of November in 1991. Their manager, a Sven-Göran Eriksson. It was apparently here, according to the script I've got, it was widely credited as being the game which persuaded George Graham to adopt a more cautious approach.
Colin Pate! Seriously. But which was a shame because people tend to forget that was always regarded as a really bad defeat because like, the goals were raining in. We beat Austria Vienna 6-1 in the first round, didn't we? Scoring goals for fun. But we only lost that game in injury time. People seem to forget
extra time.
People seem to forget that, you know, for that 90 minutes we were the better team throughout that match, and it was only in like, you know, extra time they got their two kind of goals. If that did change all of Graham's like philosophy and he got rid of Thomas and Rocastle, what a crying shame that you based it on an extra, you know, it's extra time.
It was. I mean that side, and you know, George is always regarded as being a very defensive coach, but up until that game, and even towards the end of that season, to be fair, we were one of the most attacking sides. We had some great attacking people. And, you know, with lights of Rocastle and Wrighty had just joined, even Kevin Campbell was looking good at that point. It was a crying shame that, as Mark says, that he sort of tore up that game plan and changed it all the following season.
It must have been the tipping point in some way. Maybe he had a particular kind of vision and thought that vision's got to change. I mean, like you're saying there, I think sometimes people look back at the Graham era and say we play boring football, but I just can't agree with that. There's sort of two parts of his era, you know, when we won lots of things and then towards the end when it wasn't going so well, but you can't win league titles and play boring football. I don't believe that's possible. You know, generally if you're going to win titles, you've got to be winning games. To win games, you're scoring goals. Goals are exciting. People want to see goals. You know, towards the earlier part of his time, you know, those seasons, sort of 89-ish, say to 92, we played a lot of great football. We scored a lot of great goals. Yeah. They had really talented players. It's a shame that maybe after the Benfica, maybe it did start to take that sort of turn. We won, you know, obviously a few cups, but in the league we weren't so great. Yeah, maybe the slide was pretty long from that point.
people can knock it as much as they want, and you know, he might have changed his view on the game, but ultimately it took two, maybe 3 years, and next thing we know, our incredibly weak side has beaten the all-star Parma team in the European Commons Cup.
Yeah. Well, that was the legacy of that Benfica game in a funny kind of way. So, I mean, you could argue George should have kept the creativity, but in fairness to George, the way he changed it did at least bring three further trophies.
Yeah.
You know, obviously the football became rather predictable. It's ironic that Stefan Schwartz played for that Benfica team and then was then purchased by George not too long afterwards. My main memory of that game, funny enough, is the... I mean, people think about early leavers at the current stadium. My God, the exodus of people when we went 3-1 down in extra time was incredible. It was literally three men and a dog by the time of the final whistle. Except for the Benfica section.
Sounds like playing games at the Emirates after 85 minutes.
Yeah, well, it was much worse than that. It's a memory of how just people just thought, oh, that's it, you know, I'm off, I'm not staying to the end of this. I mean, in fairness, we would have had to score three goals or something in 10 minutes or whatever it was. But, I mean, it was a tie that could have gone either way, and... I mean, I suppose it gave George the excuse to indulge himself in the defence, but it didn't work in the league. It did actually work in the Cups, because the one thing about that was players can raise their game a certain amount of times every season to just make sure the opposition don't score, and that's what happened. But they chose those games as the Cup games, and gave us some good memories, even if overall it's not regarded fondly in the memory for the actual entertainment.
But it did take a while, didn't it, for that to happen? Because as Mike said, at the end of that season, you had the games like the 7-1 against Sheffield Wednesday, when Kevin Campbell had his scintillating 20-minute cameo, the kind of 4-1 against Palace and the 5-2 against Southampton. There was goals galore at the end of that season when we were hurtling up the league and we didn't quite get into the European place. I think we came fourth. But it was still a brilliant end to the season with goals raining in, and there was that seminal Gunner back cover. Had a list of all our strikers that we had at that point. It was a very good caricature. I remember it very, very vividly now, saying, we've got Wrighty, we've got Smith, we've got Merson, you know, and brackets, and also Perry Groves. And it was still to this day a brilliant back cover. Check it out, back issue fans.
Yeah, and I mean, the other thing is that although he did wait until the end of the season before he really sort of changed, the change was in the players he let go and the players he brought in. So it was a personnel thing. He bought personnel for new tactics and basically destroyed the midfield, which meant they were bypassed. So after that, it was, if you're in midfield, look over your head, you know.
I think in some respects, you know, what he did, Graham, there's a certain element of vision there, in that Barcelona are apart in terms of how they rip teams apart at the moment. And the Champions League, a lot of the time, is not about the best team winning it. It's about knowing how to keep going through, and certain teams have won Champions Leagues by being tight. You can draw a bunch of games and go through. You could, you know, once you get to the knockouts, you could draw every game and still win the Champions League. So maybe he saw something, Graham, in the future about, you don't have to just be wonderful and you know, spank every team. Keep making sure you get through. Perhaps he didn't have the team to achieve it early on, but certain teams have won the Champions League without playing wonderful football or being the best team in Europe.
Probably the new realisation that against Italian teams you have to play calcio rather than football. Very quickly, November 3rd, 1993, Arsenal won 7-0 away to Standard Liège. We know who six of the goal scorers are. Anybody know who the young midfielder scoring his only Arsenal goal was?
Eddie McGoldrick.
There were two midfield players scoring their own goal.
Eddie McGoldrick scored a belcher of a goal, Eddie McGoldrick. It's fantastic. Yeah, it's phenomenal.
Ian Selly
was the other one. 24th of November 1996, Arsene Wenger had only recently arrived, maybe a month beforehand. It was 1-0 until relatively late on.
Peeing down with rain.
That's Sheffield Wednesday game,
eh? No.
Tottenham. And Tottenham had scored their goal with something dodgy, I can't remember.
Yeah, no, it was a throw-on, wasn't it? It was the player injured. one. Of, I don't know whether it was one of theirs or one of our players injured.
Someone was
and
injured.
And we put the ball out for a throw, and they took it and played on and scored.
Mm.
Yeah.
So they got their just desserts, courtesy of Messrs. Adams and Bergkamp. And I was right in line. I was standing behind where Adams shot from, and the way that ball fizzed into the net. And the amount of rain on the net splashed up as the ball hit the net. It was one of the great moments.
Bergkamp's celebration as well. Sliding to his knees by the corner flag. Yeah.
It's days like that you live for.
Perhaps a just equal result, certainly in a far bigger game from a certain point of view, was 9th of November the next year. We beat Manchester United 3-2, despite going 2-0 up through... Nicholas Anelka's first goal for the club. Patrick Vieira scored a belter from straight from a corner that went in open.
Injured himself in the celebration. Mm.
Yeah, he did the knee slide as well, didn't he? Was that,
and then at that point we conceded two goals, and it was a David Platt header.
Yeah, wonderful Platty header, and that
didn't
was
shoot.
A huge, huge game in that title race. Sorry, Mark.
Didn't Sheringham score for United as well, and he went mental. He got the equaliser, didn't he? And he went absolutely bonkers, like Sheringham also did. So when Platty scored that winner, I just looked at his telly and thought, that's for you, you tosser. Oh, phenomenal.
He was a horrible player, Teddy Sheringham. For more reasons you could possibly imagine. Next here, 1999, Lee Dixon and his testimonial against Real Madrid. Simon, any idea what happened in that game?
I seem to recall we won 3-1.
Hey!
Well done, Simon Rose.
Up the arse.
Phenomenal.
Fair play to Lee Dixon for taking a punt and paying the money to get decent opposition for a testimonial, because that's what testimonials are about. You take a chance on the opposition, hoping that people will buy tickets, and Real Madrid don't come cheap. So, I mean, it was a sellout, and the prices were normal prices, I think, so... It was a gamble that paid off, unlike, for example, Tony Adams' first test.
Crystal Palace.
And he got them along for 5p, but people weren't going to pay to watch that. So, Real Madrid were, obviously they're what they are now, but even then, they were in the middle of winning 3 Champions Leagues in 5-year period, so they were pretty useful. Couldn't have come cheap. So, well done, Lee Dixon.
2001, November the 5th. As much as anything else, was a Monday. We beat Manchester United 4-0 in the League Cup. If for nothing else, we had 2 games in 2 days. A game the day before against Charlton, during which Richard Wright scored an own goal and then played again the next night. Anyone remember who scored the Arsenal hat-trick?
Wiltord.
Sylvain Wiltord. Can you remember which Arsenal player got sent off after coming on as a substitute?
Oh. So Jason Crowe, that wasn't that game.
No,
so that was Birmingham City, Jason Crowe.
John Halls,
absolutely, yeah. So, apparently, Paul Scholes refused to play for Manchester United. Is that true?
Yeah, no,
legend
true.
Has it.
No, yeah. No, it's true. It's actually in his autobiography.
I think he'd played a poor game the week before.
No, he hadn't played, he'd been left out. Yeah, okay. He'd been left out the previous game, and he threw his toys out of the pram on that one. He did a Tevez.
Bloody hell.
In the current parlance. And,
you can't believe an Alex Ferguson player would do that.
No, I mean, he has said he did get a bit of the hairdryer, and Ferguson fined him a week's wages, but he apologised the week later when he realised he'd been stupid and it all.
Can I ask what you're doing reading Paul Scholes autobiography, Mark?
Serialised in one of the papers recently.
Good answer. Somebody else saved. Yeah.
Last question about this. Anyone remember who the...
That's wrong. Sorry, correct that. He was interviewed after the Tevez incident for his memories of it.
Right.
Because he refused to play, and that was the link.
Fair enough.
Got myself out of that one.
Who's your Arsenal squad player / Tottenham supporter who we went to on being released from Arsenal? Made his one and only Arsenal first team appearance in that game.
David Bentley.
No.
Currently playing for Shamrock Rovers.
Rohan Ricketts.
Rohan Ricketts is a great answer. That will do. The next game has some brilliant personal memory. It's Arsenal winning 5-1 in the San Siro against Inter, Internazionale. It was 2-1 to Arsenal. Yeah, 2-1. We're after about 85 minutes, and then Henri scored, at which point my brother, who had a broken leg at the time, was absolutely delirious, because Arsenal weren't the favourites that game by any stretch of the imagination, and he had a tenner on Arsenal to win 3-1, which was And at that point, he's trying to jump around on his broken leg. And then at that point, he sees Arsenal surge forward again. And he breaks down on his knee and starts hugging the television, using the sentence, "Don't humiliate them. Don't humiliate them." And when Edu scores the fourth after a cross from Jeremy Aliadier of everyone else, he starts punching the TV and crying.
A game I missed and never saw alive.
Why?
Really?
Why?
I had tickets to see David Bowie at Wembley Arena 4 months before. I thought we were going to get absolutely hammered. We thought we might at the very, very best get away
at home, didn't we?
And it was a really, really great gig. I come out thinking that was brilliant. I don't care if Arsenal have lost. Looked at that result. Back in those days, it was a text I got from a mate before iPhones or your smartphones. And I thought, you're winding me up. There's no way that result actually happened. And I went from this massive gig euphoria, seeing a legend of rock music, to being absolutely gutted, like I made the total wrong choice. And I was entirely devastated on the way home. Oh. So there we go. That night, Arsenal let me down by that result. The bastards. Oh, why could they have lost?
Because we'd been 3-0 on the verge of going out, weren't we? The previous game before the Inter Milan, we played Kiev,
Ashley Cole scored
in the 90th minute to keep our hopes of qualifying alive.
Mm.
But we still had to go to Inter Milan and we go, well, if we get a draw and this result happens and this result happens, we've still got a chance of qualifying. Not in our wildest dreams did we think we'd walk out of there with a 5-1 win.
Simon, on the 13th November 2004, we played a game at Spurs where Jose Mourinho afterwards came out and said, it is crazy. You might as well have these teams playing hockey. Can you remember the score?
Was this the 5-4?
Certainly was the 5-4, absolutely. Absolutely. Our goals being clawed by Freddie, Patrick V, Henri Pires and Lauren. Was that a penalty?
No, I don't think it was.
No, I think it was.
Was it?
I think so.
He scored a penalty against Tottenham at home that went straight down the middle. You see Teddy Sheringham's reaction where he sees it go straight down the middle and the camera from behind the goal's got him staring at it, and when he sees it goes down the middle, he turns around and goes, "You fucking bastard."
That 5-4 game, that was I think the first game that I watched in the presence of my wasn't at the game, I was at home watching it on TV, but in the presence of my mother-in-law.
That was eventful.
Yeah, I was very restrained for the first 5 minutes, and then she sort of left the room and realised that the language might get a little fruity, and what a game that was.
It was one of those games where it stopped making sense. It's a bit like the Chelsea game recently, the 5-3. It was just crazy. It didn't make sense as a football match because it was just so topsy-turvy and so many goals going in. I couldn't believe it. I mean, funny enough, I actually felt a bit deflated in the end because Spurs had scored 4 goals and they were on the up at the end of the game because they were coming back and they could have got the equaliser. So we almost let them back in. And that kind of finished for me with a little bit of anticlimax. And you should be wonderful having beaten your rivals 5-4 at their place, but it's just such a weird game. I don't think it made any sense at all.
Pires scored a wonderful goal where the quick feet.
I think that was the winning goal, actually.
So the fifth one, or fourth or fifth one, yeah. Mm. That was just wonderful. It was a joy to see Pires and that sort of thing.
Ah, the memories, Bobby.
You get some matches where you could just play on for hours and there wouldn't be any goals.
Yeah.
You get some games, if you play another 10 minutes, you get another one, another few minutes, they get one. It just carry on. Mm.
2008-2009, we won 2-1 versus Manchester United, where it was the first game where we had the poppy stitched into our shirt, and it absolutely pissed down with rain. Anybody got any idea who scored our 2 goals?
Was it Omri and Van Persie?
2009. Sammy Nasri is the correct answer, Simon. Absolutely.
Somebody got injured, Van Persie? Am I getting confused? What was that game?
Let's face it, probably if it was in the past, Van Persie probably did get injured.
No, he got injured scoring one against United.
That was when Omri scored the year before.
I find the
2-1 or 2-2 was that?
We went 1-0 down with about 78 minutes gone. Right. Then he equalised. He lunged himself at one on the far post and broke his toe.
Yeah, and then Omri scored with a header in the last 91st minute.
It was 2-1.
That's what I meant. What year was that? 2006.
Year before, I think.
Isn't that too far off? You give me a hard time.
Sorry.
And our last game to talk about is from last season, where we won 4-2 away at Aston Villa. Someone scored their first goal for the club and turned down and kissed their badge, that kind of thing. Any Wilshere? Ideas? Jackie Wilshere is a great answer. I think that's your hat trick, actually, Simon.
Fantastic.
Unfortunately, we don't have a match ball. There are some Chinese crackers still left.
Similar.
Yeah, that was one of those games where we went 2-0 up, conceded a goal and started bricking it, didn't we?
Yes.
Thought he'd get into the pattern where we...
It was one where both the Villa goals were a bit dodgy, if I remember rightly.
Yeah.
There was one where there was a player standing right in front of whoever we had in goal.
Oh, it was Fabianski in goal rather than Mooney.
In an offside position.
We wore that a rather odd Bradford City away kit, from memory.
The rhubarb and custard one.
I didn't mind the rhubarb and custard one.
You didn't mind that?
No. But what I find quite disconcerting is, the games that were 2-3 years ago, I have no memory of at all. Mm. The ones from 1991 are clear as crystal.
Yes.
I think that's the start of sanity, isn't it?
I'm there, mate. I've been there for about 10 years, so welcome to the club.
It's quite. This is depressing, knowing this podcast.
You've always got the memories, mate. It might be 20 years old, but they're still there.
I can picture that Benfica 3-1 now. I can't remember 2 years
ago. The thing
ago.
Is, you're blotting out the bad times. Now, if you think about people who are younger, this is the stuff that's going to be vivid to them.
Yes. 20 years time. Yeah. A life lesson for you all listening out there. A life lesson.
Right, that is your lot for this evening. We'll be back with another set of podcasts in December, but in the meantime, if you want to email us about anything related to the podcast, the address is goonapodcast@gmail.com. Thanks as ever to our sponsors at goonashirts.com. I'm your host, David Edo, saying goodbye, and thank you so very much for listening.
La-di-da-di-da, la-di-da-di-dee, all good friends and jolly good company, way!